But all illegals, especially the long-time ones, feared one thing even more than exposure and capture. Recall to Moscow. The end of this cushy existence. The end of comfort and abundance. To be cast down again into the pit of Russian sloth and bureaucracy and deprivation, with a headquarters desk, a dingy apartment, and perhaps a subcompact car with a medal to wear at ceremonies. The end of foreign assignments, and even of personal foreign travel. Forever. And this blue-eyed chief of CI just made reference to Susan's many years in America, and could conceivably make trouble over a stupid regulation. She sullenly gave Dominica the address of a dead drop in Manhattan, along with a description. Okay, a way to identify our silky-voiced friend. But now Dominica had to get to Gable to tell him her plan before her last 2 days were spent in the protective shadow of Sergeant Bloken. No more pushing little Miss Susan. She mustn't become suspicious. Conversation tailed off. The meeting was over. Consistent with established tradecraft procedures, Dominica left the mausoleum first and returned to Manhattan. She never saw the other woman again. Russians don't say that someone is a top pro, they say, Podkovat blochu, that someone can shoo a flea. This woman was like that. Even after a 15-minute meeting with the illegal, standing 3 feet away, Dominica couldn't have picked Susan out of a crowd if her life depended on it. And she knew eventually it probably would. Dominic's Sausage, Pepper, and Onion Calzone. Sauté thinly sliced red and yellow bell peppers, thinly sliced half-moons of onion, and finely minced garlic until soft. Season, add dried oregano and red pepper flakes. Add crumbled Italian sausage, and continue cooking until meat is browned. Let mixture cool, then stir in mozzarella, parmesan, and chopped parsley. On a floured surface, roll out 7-inch rounds of pizza or bread dough. Place a small amount of meat mixture in the center of the dough circles, then fold over and seal the edges with a water-wet finger. Use a fork to press a flute pattern into the dough along the seam and poke a small steam hole on top. Brush tops with olive oil. Bake in a medium-high oven on a cookie sheet until golden brown. Let rest slightly and serve lukewarm with heated marinara sauce. Chapter 9. Cradle Snacking. The bohemian charm of Staten Island left behind, Dominica and Gable were sitting shoulder to shoulder on the banquette in the back of a little bar in Chelsea on Hudson Street, called Employees Only. It was late and the bar was half full. A small plate of Parmesan Frico cups filled with tomato salad sat untouched between Gable's beer and Dominica's wine. Dominica had just finished telling Gable about her trip to Staten Island, going into the Vanderbilt mausoleum, and the spooky meeting in the dark with the illegal. Gable shook his head and took a sip of beer.
"You didn't see her face at all?" Gable said.
"Not even the color of her hair," said Dominica. "She stayed in the shadows the whole time. She was very good. I did not push it."
"Jesus wept. And you think she uses Staten Island to meet agents?" asked Gable.
"She said it was well-suited for operations," said Dominica.
"But Staten Island goes on forever. How could you cover it?" Gable shrugged. "Facial recognition software and cameras at the ferry terminal might pick her up," said Gable.
"If we knew what she looked like, perhaps," said Dominica, "but we do not."
"Yeah, tell me something I don't know," said Gable. "She could drive her ass over one of the bridges, too."
"May I tell you an idea about how we could identify her?" said Dominica. "I'm thinking we could take a page out of the old KGB handbook."
Gable drank some more beer. "I could order 2 more drinks if this is going to take long," he said. Dominica smiled and patted his arm.
"Terpenye, patience, Bratok. You will like this," she said. "Now listen. Before I leave New York, I ordered Susan, yes, ordered her most sternly, to retrieve my encrypted personal mobile phone from a dead drop site of her choosing in Manhattan for destruction and secure disposal."
"And she went for that?"
"I used my colonel's voice on her. Russians respond to bullying."
"You sure as hell don't," said Gable.
"That is because you never bully me," said Dominica.
"I'm too scared to," said Gable. Okay, you dead drop your phone, we set up an ambush and bag her ass? That's no good. It puts you in hot water.
I'm not thinking of an ambush, which we must avoid for exactly that reason. We just have to pass the physical item in a timed drop at a site of her choosing, someplace that offers her absolute security. No ambushes, no surveillance at the site.
Gable looked at her sideways. I'm waiting for the punchline, he said.
We dust the cell phone with Metka.
Schmegma? Said Gable, being obtuse. What the hell's that?
Dominika laughed. She knew the obscure word from Sparrow's school. You are a real krutoi parin, a sharp fellow. You know very well what I said. Metka, not schmegma. Spy dust, like the KGB used in Moscow to track Americans. I'm sure Benford has chemists who could prepare a compound.
Moscow will still wonder how they lost their sleeper, said Gable.
Dominika shrugged. They will not connect me with her eventual arrest, not if you catch her months later by using spy dust. Of course, the Kremlin will be annoyed, but the center will rationalize that 20 years as an illegal in the United States exceeds all expectations of survival, said Dominika. I know the Russian mind. They will be looking for someone to blame. But if we do this right, Line S will never divine how she was identified, nor will they appreciate the irony that Metka was used against them after all these years. Susan will naturally follow orders and destroy the phone, leaving no evidence but her invisibly contaminated hands.
Not bad. I'll run it by Benford.
He picked up his phone, pushed a speed dial, and Westfall appeared in the bar 2 minutes later, gulping as he shook Dominica's hand again, mumbling like an embarrassed butler. Dominika got up and gave Westfall a chaste hug of greeting, with the result that he turned vermilion. Gable repeated a summary of Dominika's plan to him, told him to call Benford on the secure line and get working on it. They had 2 days to cook up their own batch of Metka. Lucius bowed that he understood. Gable shook his head at Westfall's awkwardness.
You gonna click your heels like a Prussian?
Dominika dug her elbow into Gable's ribs. Leave him alone, she said. Lucius, do you understand the plan?
Lucius nodded. We do this right, Dommy's in the clear and Sugar Britches glows in the dark until Christmas, said Gable.
What is this Sugar Britches? Said Dominika.
Skip it, figure of speech.
I am sure, said Dominika, looking sideways at him. Westfall, do you know what it means?
Westfall gulped, shook his head, and left, saying he'd call Benford right now.
Dominika felt even sorrier for him than before.
Okay, so the Phoebes check after hours the offices of the leading literary magazines in Manhattan, how many of them can there be, and see whose spaces glow under a black light, said Gable.
Dominika held up a cautionary finger. There is some need for attention with Metka. The KGB had difficulty with overcontamination. In a week, Susan will shake many hands, distribute memos, and conduct business lunches in restaurants. In several months, everyone in publishing in New York will be covered in the stuff, not to mention half the talent agents in the United States.
No one's going to worry about them, said Gable, finishing his beer.
Josip Blokin was walking down Hudson Street in Chelsea, head pointed down, fixated on the sidewalk, bulling forward without apparent regard for other pedestrians, lampposts, or garbage cans. He did not care about the incongruity of wearing a massive pair of wraparound fisherman's sunglasses at 10 o'clock in the evening, and he ignored the occasional stares from amused passers-by. He looked like a sightless wrestler without the tapping white cane. The glasses were in fact developed by Line T to detect faint residual traces of nuclear isotopes in order to track a target at undetectable long ranges. Blokin was tracking Dominika on the secret express orders of Major Shlikov, and unbeknownst to Anton Gorelikov. Shlikov had instructed Blokin to begin tailing Miss SVR Tits after her Staten Island meeting. Even Shlikov would not meddle with that, but continuously thereafter until they departed New York. Shlikov wanted Blokin to ensure that the SVR would not steal the magnet case, and that Dominika was not meeting with officers from the New York Residentura, preparatory to claiming primacy, or engaging in any number of bureaucratic maneuvers to usurp the case.
Shlikov stipulated to Blokin that Igorova was not to know about the surveillance. He would not risk the wrath of Gorelikov, so coverage was to be discreet.
"She's supposed to be good on the street, so let her go if you can't cover her discreetly," Shlikov had told Blokin. "Do not let her see you." The Spetsnaz gorilla picked his teeth. "Well, if I see her doing something interesting," he said quietly.
Shlikov had looked at the scarred forehead.
"Like what?" he said. "Like meeting someone I don't recognize," said Blokin.
Shlikov looked him in the eyes. "It could be an officer from the Residentura."
"Perhaps. But if it's not someone I know, it could be a double deal. Maybe even on Gorelikov's orders."
"What are you saying?" said Shlikov. Blokin looked at his hands. "Igorova is not yet director of SVR, and she is already causing problems. When they give her a star, she'll be untouchable." Shlikov turned away from Blokin to shuffle some papers. "You already have one problem to eliminate."
"Why leave a second one to fester?" asked Blokin.
"Only if you are 100%, no traces."
"Shemobit tomu ne minuvat," said Blokin. "Things that were meant to be will happen no matter what."
With Shlikov's brevet to operate against Igorova, Blokin waited for Dominika's departure for Staten Island, entered her hotel room, and using a tool resembling a grommet punch, sunk a pinhead-sized disc of the medical isotope palladium-103, used for cancer radiation treatment, into the leather heels of the three pairs of shoes in her little closet, and returned them exactly as he had found them, after an appraising sniff at each shoe. The tiny palladium tags in her shoe heels would leave luminous orange dots, viewable by special gamma glasses on pavement, flat carpet, marble, or wood, but would be scattered and obscured in leaves, grass, or sand. Palladium-103, moreover, had been chosen as a surveillance tool for its rapid decay rate, which would ensure a target would not inadvertently discover the tracking technique. The orange dots, therefore, would just support over-the-horizon surveillance, but had a tendency to dissipate in adverse weather or on less-than-ideal surfaces. Stronger, more pervasively radioactive isotopes had been ruled out when tests on Gulag prisoners resulted in an unacceptable rate of bone marrow cancers and foot amputations. Blokin was trying to follow Igorova and Chelsea from her hotel using trailing breadcrumb surveillance, but the brisk temperatures and a light mist was dissipating the tag marks. When he lost the trail for the third time, he crossed the street to see if he could pick up the trail, but after another 30 minutes he gave up. There were 2 more days and perhaps something would develop. As Dominika sat in the little bar next to Gable, her face blanched and a shot of ice went up her spine. She saw through the bar's far window Blokin's thick body walking on the sidewalk. In 5 seconds he would be past the window directly opposite their banquet table. All he had to do would be to look inside. The interior was brighter than the street outside, and he would see Dominika sitting alone with a man in a city she didn't know, had never visited before, and conclude only one thing. Spion. Spy. She grabbed Gable's arm in a panic. The banquette trapped her, and she couldn't slip under the table. She pointed with her chin and whispered, "Blokin, outside." Gable didn't hesitate. He moved so fast that Dominika felt his arms around her shoulders in a twisting clinch that had his broad back to the window, and Dominika totally screened before she felt his lips on hers. "Move," Gable growled into her mouth, and she ran one hand through his crew cut. His arms were like steel around her, and his kiss was dry and firm. He smelled like soap and leather. She opened one eye and looked out the window and saw that Blokin was gone.
"Clear?" whispered Gable.
"Give it 10 seconds more," said Dominika, giggling, her cheek against Gable's. He let her go and sat back, looking at her ruefully. Dominika knew there was not a thought of sex in the kiss. Gable had reacted as quickly as he would have drawn his pistol on a gomer with an AK-47 in a Beirut alleyway. He just used what was available, an enveloping smooch. But Gable, for all his gruffness, was chaste to her, always had been. Nate had told her once that a young Gable had been married when he joined the agency 1 million years ago to a beauty who was on her way to becoming a first-rate concert pianist.
But the life in the Third World claimed more of Gable than his bride was willing to give, and his frequent absences, the constant moving, and having to boil the tap water to kill the Giardia parasites was too much. She left Gable the morning that F-sharp above middle C wouldn't play, and she lifted the lid on the baby grand and found a horned puff adder asleep on the felt hammers. Gable resolved to patch things up, but a year later she died in a crash on an icy highway 4 miles from home. Gable was in Peru facilitating the kinetic retirement of a local drug dealer who had brought a knife to a gunfight when they told him. He never married again, but Nate had whispered that her name was Moira. He never talked about her except once to Nate. "That's what the life leaves you," Nate said to Dominica during one of his harangues about defecting. Gable's face was serious over the near miss with Bloken. "Is this going to be trouble?" he asked.
"Was he tracking your phone?"
Dominica shook her head. "I did not carry the phone today. I made sure I was black before I met you tonight, absolutely, but yes, I think he was looking for me. He knows where my hotel is. He could have done a long tail from there and was just casting blind along my general route to see if he could pick up my scent. We call it promivochnie pizzi, to flush a bird, an old technique. Gorelikov swore Bloken wasn't in New York to check up on me, but I don't believe it. I will see if he asks about where I was tonight. Na volosk ot, a close call. Imagine being caught in such a big city." She looked at him, tilting her head. "It is not just shooting bad men. You also kiss very well, just like James Bond. I had no idea. But after tonight, I can no longer call you Bratok, big brother. It would be inappropriate after kissing you. I'll have to call you Ledinets from now on."
"Don't start with me," growled Gable, blushing. "The fuck's that mean?"
"Ledinets," said Dominica. "Sugar candy like your sugar britches." Gable blushed some more and Dominica laughed, slid over to him, kissed his cheek, and mussed up his crew cut with her fingers. He wouldn't look at her, which she found endearing. A slovenly waiter sidled up to the table with the bar bill, having watched the old guy and Chesty McThrust necking in the corner. Gable glowered at him.
"What are you looking at?" he said.
Dominica was red in the face from holding in laughter. "Nothing," said the waiter. "No law against cradle snacking." Dominica clapped a hand over her mouth, eyes streaming. Benford sat behind the ruin of his desk in the counterintelligence division at CIA headquarters. A three-tray inbox bursting with papers on one side of the desk was missing a foot and tilted dangerously. A dozen three-ring binders were stacked on the other corner of the desk, creating a redoubt from behind which Benford scowled at the two people sitting in his office. Benford was short and slightly paunchy, and this morning his hair looked as if it had been tugged on like a salt-and-pepper beret. His big brown cow's eyes passed over the two officers sitting in front of him and settled on a sepia-toned framed photograph of James Jesus Angleton, the legendary mole hunter whose fanatic belief that the Soviets were running moles inside CIA had paralyzed Langley's Russian operations for a decade. The photograph of Angleton, like a number of other objects in Benford's office, tilted drastically. No amount of straightening would keep the photo frame squared off. Every morning it would be slanting again, confirming for Benford his private belief that the spirit of James Jesus resided in his office and knocked the photo askew every night, which suited him just fine. The two officers sitting in torn bucket chairs with wobbly casters waited. Lucius Westfall, the precocious analyst from DI and Benford's new aide, in the other chair slouched the laconic technical officer Hersey, whom Benford liked and trusted.
"Show me what you've done," said Benford. "Time is of the essence. We need to dust her phone tomorrow night."
Hersey dug into a zippered pouch, took out half a dozen black and white photographs, a large tablet, and what looked like an antique perfume atomizer with a black rubber bulb and an oval glass receptacle. "The photographs are of the various items we use to test adhesion of the compound," said Hersey. "Results are what we expected. Fibrous material, clothing, floor mats, bedclothes retain the material better and for a longer period of time. Other surfaces like plastic, glass, or metal are not as good."
The item Diva will pass the illegal is a cell phone, said Benford. It's our only choice.
Percy nodded.
Yeah, we figured that, he said. So we bought a cover she can slip over her phone. He slid a photograph across the desk to Benford. It's made of stretchy silicone that turns out to be sticky as hell and actually attracts the compound like a friggin' lint roller. He held the tablet up, tapped the corner of the screen twice, and the image of a cell phone in a glass laboratory tray appeared in normal overhead light. We doused the lights and hit it with ultraviolet. The cell phone in the next image glowed a luminous green. Benford looked up from the tablet.
Why green?
Why not, said Hersey. The Soviets used luminol and nitrophenol pentadiene. They added hydrochloric acid that turned their compound red under UV light. We didn't want to mix the same chem, so we used tetrahydrobetacarboline, the stuff that makes a scorpion carapace glow green under UV. We have a chemist named Bunny DeVore in the lab. She loves scorpions, knows all about them, keeps them as pets. Benford gave Hersey a look like a bent rebar.
Hersey, said Benford, I'm puzzled by why you think I would be even remotely interested in the chemistry or about this woman and her unsavory interest in predatory arachnids. All I care about is whether the compound is undetectable. Our agent's life depends on it.
Hersey held up the antique atomizer. Spray a target object about 2 feet away and let the droplets settle evenly. Don't worry. It's invisible. You can't feel it. You can't taste it. You can't smell it. We dissolved the chemicals in methanol, so we're actually spraying a light mist on an object, not like dusting something with fingerprint powder. It fluoresces like crazy under UV light in the 10 to 400 nanometer range, and also shows up on a gas chromatograph.
Yes, I'm sure it does all this and more, said Benford. How long does it last?
We don't know, simply because we haven't had enough time to test perpetuation, said Hersey. It adheres well, and propagation, how it transfers, seems good. If your illegal handles that phone cover, then it hits a light switch in her office, touches her keyboard, or drinks coffee from a mug. We can find her.
Benford nodded. I'll trouble you to courier this personally to New York today with Westfall. Connect with Gable and explain it all to him. I'll ask you to spray the phone and its cover yourself, keep Diva completely away from it, and ensure she can load the phone in a dead drop site of the illegal's choosing without contaminating herself.
Percy nodded and unfolded his lanky frame to stand up and get going.
Percy, I'm appreciative of the work you've done in such a timely manner, said Benford. You have my thanks. I would have in years past written up an exceptional performance award for you, or a laudatory unit citation for your team, but in the achromatic agency of today, I'm reduced instead to presenting you with a gift certificate to the Starbucks Coffee Emporium here in headquarters so you can enjoy what the gum-chewing young woman behind the counter astoundingly calls a grand cafe latte with milk.
Angleton looked down on them slantedicular from the wall. Parmesan Frico Appetizers. Mix coarsely grated parmesan and flour, then season with red pepper flakes and black pepper. Spoon cheese in a medium-hot non-stick pan, flatten gently into a thin disc, and cook until golden on both sides. Drape still hot Frico over an inverted shot glass or teacup, and let cool and harden into a Parmesan cup. Fill with a bruschetta mixture of diced tomatoes and shallots, seasoned with sugar, oregano, red wine vinegar, and olive oil.
Chapter 10. Heaven versus Hell. The penultimate day in New York. The meeting with Susan was concluded, there were no messages from Gorelikov in the Kremlin, and the fundraising event with Russian dissident Daria Rapina was at 6 o'clock that evening, at the Hilton on 6th Avenue. Dominika made a big show of meeting Blokin in the morning and walking around Manhattan with him. They had all day. She planned to slip away after the Rapina event and meet once more with Gable to spritz her phone with spy dust and emplace it in Susan's Manhattan dead drop site, an unknown pocket cemetery on a residential side street. She wouldn't have to accompany Blokin after 6 o'clock. They were returning separately the morning after, Dominika through Paris and Bucharest, Blokin through Berlin. Blokin wore a jacket with all three buttons tightly secured, bumpkin style. He was stiff and formal as they walked, affecting not to look at the wonders of the city, the traffic, the people, and the display windows, as cool as if butter wouldn't melt in his mouth.
But Dominica saw him sneaking looks, and she wondered how his Spetsnaz-wired brain was processing the maelstrom of wealth and industry swirling before his impassive face. He walked well-balanced with his arms at his sides and his wood-clamp hands hanging loose, free and ready for action. His forehead gleamed in the sunlight. Dominica darted glances at his ruddy profile. He could have been a farmer or an outdoor laborer. Yet the peasant's face reflected God knows what horrors. He did not speak to her, and Dominica elected not to make small talk with him. What would they say to each other in any event? Look how tall the buildings are. How much is that in rubles? What did you use to hang the Afghan president's mistress off the palace balcony? Dominica was taller by a head, but Bloken's body was thick. No, dense, like stone. From behind, there was a small bald spot visible through his thinning hair, but he combed his hair to cover as much of it as he could. They were walking on one of the avenues moving through the crush of pedestrians when a lanky street person blocked their path, calling Dominica honey and asking for a dollar. Dominica had seen this several times before and knew there was no danger, but Bloken, perhaps not understanding, he had told Dominica he spoke no English, in a gliding step put his forearm across the beggar's chest and swept him aside as if walking through a field of ripe wheat. The beggar caught himself and took a step back toward Bloken, but the irresistible force of the shove transmitted some jungle warning to avoid confrontation with this cat, and he let them go, shouting obscenities as they walked away.
"You show restraint on the street," barked Dominica to Bloken in Russian. "We are here in undocumented alias. Back in Moscow, you can kill whomever you want, but not here. Not when you're with me."
Bloken looked at Dominica as if deciding whether to bite, then looked past her and said,
"Obojda,
wait," and pulled open the door to a bookstore and went in, Dominica on his heels. The store was enormous, with three floors of books on shelves and tables and people reading in overstuffed chairs, the air laced with the aroma of brewed coffee from a cafe on the second level. Dominica watched Bloken scan a store directory, squinting like a Visigoth reading a milepost on the road to Rome, until he walked to the fiction section and found Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment, which he looked at closely, rifling the pages.
"You have no English," said Dominica. "How can you read it?"
Bloken looked at her blankly.
"There are editions in the original Russian you could read instead," she said.
"I want to learn English. I will teach myself," he said, as casually as if he had declared, "I will learn to bake bread."
Bloken's black bat wings spread, then folded. He was lying about something, she decided. Perhaps he read English.
"Why this book?" said Dominica.
It was quite amazing, this squat commando gripping the paperback like a pistol determined to start reading.
"I've been told about this work. It is a great Russian novel."
Told by whom? Sitting around the Spetsnaz squad room, honing bayonets, discussing Dostoevsky?
"It is about permissible murder in pursuit of a higher purpose," said Bloken with surprising lucidity.
"Something you would feel at home with, no doubt," thought Dominica. She left him gazing at the books, left the bookstore, walked to a shoe store three doors down, and began looking at strappy sandals on display. She meant to conduct a little street test. How would Bloken react when he looked up from his books to find Dominica gone? Was he here in New York to keep tabs on her?
"Do you like this style?" asked Bloken suddenly behind her, making her jump.
He was slipping a pair of sunglasses into his jacket pocket, and he took the sandal from her and inspected it, rubbing his dill-pickle fingers over the leather. How had he found her so quickly, with hundreds of shops 50 meters from the bookstore? She'd have to double-check her status before meeting Gable tonight. Sergeant Bloken was someone with secret skills and not just cutting throats. A copy of his novel was in a small plastic bag. Bloken then declared himself hungry and insisted they go into a Korean restaurant for barbecued ribs, which he had consumed in great quantities during past joint commando exercises in North Korea. Bloken inhaled the gleaming ribs accompanied by mounds of vermilion kimchi, green onion and cucumber salad, and samjang, a spicy paste smeared on accompanying lettuce leaves. Blowing garlic like a contented whale, Bloken next dived into a sprawling sporting goods store and spent an hour looking at wire saws, clamp hatchets, machetes, and survival knives. His eyes said everything. He expertly appraised each item as a weapon, a killing instrument. "This is an ingenious tool," said Bloken, running the teeth of a wire saw lightly over his fingertips. "Loop this over a branch, pull it back and forth with these handles, and it cuts wood like a regular pila, a saw." Ingenious indeed, thought Dominica. A throat would cut easier than a pine bough. "You won't be allowed on the plane with any of this stuff," Dominica told him in Russian. "Cable the Residentura to pouch one back for you, or two. One for Major Shlikov as well. I'm sure his trees need pruning too." Bloken ignored the comment and put the saw down. Dominica wanted to create just enough enmity between them so that she could feign mounting dislike and impatience and leave the Rapina reception early to rendezvous with Gable. "It would be wise not to make an enemy of the Major," said Bloken softly, several minutes later back out on the street. "Why is that?" said Dominica. "Because then you would become my enemy," he said, the tips of his black airfoils extending slightly behind his head, like a cobra flaring his neck hood in threat display. The grand ballroom of the Hilton was a colossal space, lighted by chandeliers and triple-gilded lanterns in recessed circular alcoves high on the walls. A crowd of 1,000 people filled row upon row of chairs lined up almost to the back of the room. Loggia levels on either side had been reserved for press. Television cameras on tripods bristled and television lights bathed the raised stage, framed with a royal purple velour border and leg curtains. A solitary lectern and microphone stood center stage. Bloken wanted to sit in the front row to listen to Rapina's presentation, but Dominica refused, preferring instead an aisle seat halfway back near the exit doors. Bloken argued that closer was better until Dominica sat down where she wanted and refused to budge. "The seats up close will be in sight of the cameras. You wish to be on the evening news?" Bloken did not respond, but sat down next to her. The ballroom was abuzz and raucous. Different groups of supporters waved signs printed with "Freedom for Russia" and "Putin Murderer" and "Out of Free Ukraine." A number of other placards were printed in Cyrillic. Bloken nudged Dominica to look at one of these that said, "Hang Putin by the neck." Bloken's face had taken on a sleepy-eyed languor that, had she known the Spetsnaz sergeant better, would have telegraphed his building rage. An official came onto the stage, spoke about donating funds to Darya Rapina's Free Russia movement, then began a lengthy introduction which was briefly interrupted by a knot of young students waving little Russian flags and chanting, "Rapina Poshelti," which loosely translated meant, "Rapina, fuck off." Bloken and Dominica exchanged glances. They knew these pro-Russian agitators were one of the tentacles of the Kremlin's active measures octopus, a global machine designed to perpetually sow discord, drive wedges, and influence opinion. Tomorrow it might be desinformatsiya, disinformation in a respected U.S. or international paper, the day after a forged document that would inflame the Arab street against socialist Europe or pit member EU states against one another, and the day after that political sabotage to fuel a coup in Montenegro to destabilize the Balkans. Active measures were an unceasing staple of the Kremlin's foreign policy, and had been since the Bolsheviks annihilated white Russian exiles hiding in Europe in the 1920s. A brief scuffle between agitators and supporters broke out, chairs were overturned, and hotel security bustled the pro-Russia hotheads out of the ballroom. As their departing chants died away, the lights dimmed, a spot focused on the podium, and Darya Rapina walked on stage to thunderous applause. She was tall and gaunt, with short brown hair and a tight pixie cut that fell in bangs to one side of her face. Her face was severe, lined by the strain of opposing, campaigning against, and exposing the crimes and corruption of the Putin regime for close to a decade. She had begun her jihad against Vladimir Vladimirovich as a little-known journalist, and was muzzled, shoved, and fined by the police for her misdemeanors. The world began noticing when Rapina began touring Europe and the United Kingdom, raising awareness during impassioned rallies. The famous speech at Royal Albert Hall in London marked a turning point, and the Free Russia movement was born. After 2 months in the United States, serious money started pouring in, and Rapina became the face of dissident Russia. Coy interviewers frequently asked her if she feared for her life. After all, Daria had been preceded by prominent journalists, disloyal government officials, and opposition party luminaries, all of whom were now gone. Nemtsov, Berezovsky, Politkovskaya, Klebnikov, Litvinenko, Estemirova, Lessin. Shot, poisoned, or fed polonium-210, they all had been eliminated as threats to the president's sole priority as head of state, to preserve his kleptocracy. Daria would invariably reply that Putin's time was running out because what he feared most, Russian citizens demonstrating in Red Square, was an inevitability. The eyes of the world were on her now. She was inviolate. Rapina started speaking. Her mannish voice was electric. Her passion and energy flowed into the ruby-red halo that shone about her head and shoulders, proclaiming passion, courage, and her love for the Rodina and for the people of Russia, once serfs, then inmates in a Soviet Union without windows, and now impossibly serfs again, crying out to the West to understand, to help them be free. When Rapina came out from behind the lectern with the microphone in her hand like a rock star and railed against the corruption and the plunder and the assassinations and the wars and the unholy alliances that had to end, the audience came out of their seats and cheered. Dominika kept her face impassive, but inwardly, she was amazed to hear a Russian speak the truth and give voice to her own indignant rage that had pushed her to CIA and a mortally dangerous life as a spy. She, Dominika, was working in the shadows, underground, while Rapina was standing on the ramparts in full sight. Her heart raced. This was an epiphany. She wasn't alone. Her countrymen were with her. Blokin was still in his seat, chin slightly raised, eyes locked on Rapina. "I cannot listen to any more of this crumola, this sedition," said Dominika, getting up, faking impatience. "I'm going to my hotel to sleep. I have an early flight." Blokin didn't move, but kept staring at the tall crusader in the spotlight, who was walking back and forth along the length of the stage, now excoriating the siloviki, the remora attached to the belly of the great white shark, feeding off the tendrils of meat dribbling out of the apex predator's jaws. "Don't start any trouble tonight," she hissed, but he ignored her. Dominika paused at the door to watch Rapina on stage, thinking she'd like to meet this charismatic woman someday. Perhaps Benford could arrange it. Then she pushed through the door, late for her rendezvous with Gable. She planned to tease him about her being tormented all day by memories of his kiss to watch him squirm. A last look at Blokin, whose black wings were unfolded over his head like a raptor about to take flight. Rapina's presentation had concluded, and she was surrounded on stage by press reporters, admirers, and even people asking for autographs. Blokin was standing quietly at the fringe of the hangers-on, smiling pleasantly and applauding with the rest of the crowd. It took an hour before Rapina and her assistant, Magda, a scruffy young Muscovite activist, were free to go to their room on the sixth floor of the hotel, paid for by the city of New York. They were escorted by two officers of the NYPD, Sergeants Moran and Bowman, veterans of the force. Bowman had served on NYPD SWAT for 6 years before blowing out a knee during an assault and returning to regular duty. Both men had volunteered for this light protective detail because they needed the overtime. This gig qualified as premium double overtime, and there wasn't any heavy lifting, basically just sitting on a hotel couch, watching TV, eating chips, and drinking Coke. Going to the rallies was a pain, but no one was going to mess with Rapina in New York City. Both sergeants were in civvies. They wore tweed sports coats over their white shirts with Glock 19s and belt holsters on their right hips. Blokin's practiced eye saw the slight bulges of the 9mm pistols through the cops' coats, called printing, in concealed carry circles, but not normally a concern to uniformed cops. Loken just caught the elevator with the four of them, apologetically skipping through the closing doors and nodding courteously to them as he moved to the back of the car. Magda was chatting with Bowman, while Rapina stared at Loken, her Russian nose sensing something familiar about him, his face, his clothes, the pheromones coming off him.
«На каком этаж вы хотите?» asked Rapina quickly in Russian.
«What floor do you want?» Loken blinked at her, and in slightly accented British English said,
«Excuse me, I'm afraid I don't speak Polish.»
Rapina smiled back and asked, «What floor?» Loken said,
«Five, please»,
having seen that Sergeant Moran, unmindful of one of the basic techniques of tradecraft, had already pushed the sixth floor button, thus revealing their destination. Rapina stared at Loken all the way up and shrugged as he stepped out on the fifth floor with another nod and a muttered, «Good evening». The two sergeants watched Scarface Loken walk down the hall as the doors eased shut.
«Most popular in his class», muttered Moran to Bowman, who nodded.
Rapina and Magda didn't get the joke. In the fifth-floor alcove, Loken peeked out, scanned the ceiling, and identified the black fisheye lenses of the security cameras, one at each end of the corridor. They could not see him in the elevator alcove. He slipped a light, full-faced neoprene balaclava over his head, pushed through the stairwell-fired doors, and ran up one flight. Rapina's group was just entering a room halfway down the hallway, and Loken waited for them to get inside and close the door. He waited another 5 minutes, subconsciously flexing his shoulders and loosening his wrists. He walked up to the room, took a cleansing breath, and knocked lightly as hotel staff or a chambermaid would knock. He dragged the hood off his head and kept his head down. If Josip Loken had been wired to monitors at that moment, his heart rate would have registered 50 beats per minute, blood pressure 110 over 70, and ventilation rate 12 breaths a minute. His galvanic skin response, an indication of stress measured in microsiemens, was at resting levels. He recognized the calm clarity that always came before combat, the sudden acuity in vision, and the sharpening of both his sense of smell and hearing. He savored the icy edge of immediate action and the gummy relish of imminent killing. He could hear muffled footfalls on the carpet coming closer. The peephole darkened a second, then came the rasp of the deadbolt moving past the strike plate as the door opened. Loken hit the door with his right shoulder, snapping the security chain and hitting Officer Bauman in the forehead with the edge of the door, and he fell back, hitting the wall with his head, trying to get on his feet, but Loken closed like a leopard on a baboon and hit him in the throat with a web hand strike, compressing his trachea and sending the cop gasping to the floor, where Loken stomped on his Adam's apple, totally crushing his windpipe. Loken rolled the strangling cop butt high to fish out the Glock from his holster, extracted the 15-round magazine to check it, then racked the slide as he walked into the sitting room of the mini-suite, picking up a bright throw pillow from an armchair and stepping up to Sergeant Moran, who was lying on the couch in his stocking feet watching a baseball game.
"Who is at the door?" said Moran, not looking away from the TV, as Loken shot him from a meter away through the pillow 4 times in the temple, cheek, and jaw, then turned to an open-mouthed Magda sitting at the desk and shot her 6 times through the now shredded pillow into her gaping mouth, forehead, and throat, knocking her backward in her chair to the floor amid a welter of pillow stuffing and fabric, floating bits of which settled on and stuck to her bloody cheek. 11 seconds had elapsed since Loken knocked on the door. Daria Rapina walked barefoot into the sitting room in a cloud of steam from the bathroom, wrapped in a hotel bathrobe too big for her, toweling her pixie hair. She stopped short, seeing Loken in the room, the queer bloke in the elevator, and her natural combativeness took over. She asked him what he was doing in her suite and to get the hell out, and who the fuck did he think he was? Loken faced her and quietly said, «Toko churomo i nevizot». Only the black cat and no luck. Mother of God, thought Rapina, only then noticing one of Magda's bare feet sticking up in the air over the upturned chair, and the blood-smeared face of one of the policemen on the sodden couch,
and she knew this man was from Moscow, sent by Putin, and she ran to the bedroom, turned to slam the bedroom door and get to the phone, but Blokhin threw her on the bed and hit her massively 4 times with a knife and hand Spetsnaz cross, a strike to the right side of her neck, crushing the brachial plexus between the collarbone and the first rib, then a cross backhand to strike the lower left rib cage, staving in the 7th and 8th ribs, which pierced the lower lobe of her left lung, then up across the left side of the neck, and back down to fracture the right rib cage, puncturing the right lung, each time forcing a grunt out of Rapina, now barely conscious. Her body shook as Blokhin sat her up and wrapped his lobster claw hands on her chin and slowly twisted her head, first one way, then the other, listening to the green sticks snap as the C2, C3, and C4 cervical vertebrae separated. Rapina flopped back on the mattress, staring sightlessly at Putin's henchman. Elapsed time, 17 seconds. Blokhin had been instructed to destroy the target with maximum unigeneve, maximum humiliation. Moscow wanted Rapina to be found in the morning, reduced to a savaged pile of flesh, a demonstration of Russian wrath, and a warning to others who dared follow her example. He roughly stripped the bathrobe off her corpse, her skinny body already was a lurid mass of hematomas, and dragged her by one ankle off the bed, her head thumping onto the floor, into the living room, broken neck wobbling into the middle of the carpet, wrists crossed above her head and legs kicked out wide, genitals cruelly exposed. He left the other bodies where they were in mute testament to the Kremlin's wrath. Blokhin scratched a B on Rapina's stomach with the minibar corkscrew, the Cyrillic V for Vimpel group of Spetsnaz, for investigators to puzzle over. He did not interfere with either of the women. The massacre tableau was enough, and he took a panoramic photo of the room with his cell phone. Total elapsed time, 3 minutes. Only the black cat and no luck. As he left the room, sliding his balaclava back over his head, he looked at his handiwork. Only one thing missing, he thought. Colonel Dominika Igorova should be lying on the carpet alongside Rapina, staring at the ceiling. Diavol. The devil. He'd tailed her after her return from meeting the illegal, but had lost her too easily. The isotope device was too weak. Shlikov said she was good on the street, and she was, better than anyone he'd encountered before. But she was a spy, after all. He knew she'd eventually make a mistake, and then Blokhin would crush her, like stepping on a snail in the garden. Blokhin's Korean barbecued ribs. Rinse Flanken-style ribs in cold water. In a separate bowl, mix soy sauce, brown sugar, rice wine, sesame oil, black pepper, and cayenne. Combine onion, garlic, pears, and ginger and process to a smooth puree, then add to the soy mixture. Add toasted sesame seeds and a splash of water to thin. Pour marinade over ribs and toss to cover. Chill overnight, then bring to room temperature and discard marinade. Grill or broil until caramelized. Serve on lettuce leaves with Samjang paste, pickled peppers, kimchi, cucumber salad, and steamed rice. Chapter 11. Pitch and Roll. Director Alexander Larson owned a Georgian row house on P Street Northwest in D.C., but on the weekends he regularly escaped to his late father-in-law's 5-bedroom ranch house near Edgewater, Maryland, on the banks of Pool's Gut, a narrow tidal creek that emptied into the South River below Annapolis, one of the hundreds of tributaries that made up the Chesapeake Bay watershed. Down the sweeping lawn from the house, there was a fixed pier alongside a paved boat launching ramp. An extended garage behind the house contained 2 small boats on trailers. One, a 25-foot black rigid inflatable boat, RIB, with a center steering console, a DECA radar mounted on an aluminum frame aft, and 2 115-horsepower Mercury outboards, beasts that could push the RIB along at 40 knots. The RIB was used by the DCIA's protective detail and had a waterproof locker just forward of the steering console, in which were stored 2 223-caliber Colt M4A1 carbines. The second vessel at the back of the garage was Larson's pride and joy, a 17-foot Lyman runabout built in 1961, with a restored lapstrake hull, graceful flared bow, and mahogany spray rails and brightwork. The distinctive angled windshield and the jaunty Lyman pennant on the bow marked the runabout as a classic, but not as much as the 1955 forest green teardrop Johnson Seahorse 25-horsepower outboard, an antique refurbished to flawless working order and perfect for running the smooth-riding hull ahead of frequent Chesapeake squalls at 20 knots, or slow trolling for striped bass at 9 knots. Two Shimano fishing rods were in beckets along the gunnels with expensive Takota trolling reels. In a seat locker under the aft banquette were two tackle boxes with lures, jigs, and spoons. Alex Larson was not a fanatical fisherman, but he enjoyed solitary time out on his boat and loved preparing striped bass a la Fiorentina, the way he had first tasted it in Rome. His wife did not enjoy going out into the middle of the bay, which could get quite rough and make the round-bottomed Lyman pitch and roll like a floating ninepin, especially in a beam sea at lazy trolling speed. Simon Benford had once reluctantly agreed to go out with Alex, but the plunging and yawning made him green, and he detested handling live bait, so he vowed the next time to stay ashore and drink Larson's scotch while his friend caught dinner. At 0600 hours on a crisp fall day, the cloudless eastern sky was going pink as the two agents of DCIA's protective detail backed both trailers into the green water of the creek. They knew Larson would be walking down from the house in 15 minutes with a thermos of coffee, a flask of bourbon, which they knew he hid from his security guys, and a roast beef sandwich wrapped in foil made by his housekeeper. The agents today were Bennett and Scott, each with 5 years' experience on the detail and more than 10 years' time in special forces. They had examined the undersides of both boats for limpet mines on the keel, checked the lockers on the Lyman, and started the Johnson outboard to let it warm up. Before the old man came down from the house, they snapped 30-round magazines into their M4s, charged and snapped the bolts closed, safed the weapons, and put them back into the footlocker. They both additionally carried 17-round 9mm Glock 17s and Frontier Gunleather CC1 holsters under their sweaters and foul weather jackets. They knew from experience that once out on the bay, it could get cold and wet in a hurry. They weren't experienced watermen, but they knew the basics. Once afloat, Bennett and Scott spun the rib on a dime and skimmed ahead along the creek to make sure it was clear, the Lyman sedately following, raising hardly a wake in the early light. No one noticed the man in the pickup truck parked on the side of Waterview Drive watching through the trees as the Lyman chugged down Pool's Gut and out onto the South River. The rib was infinitely faster than the Lyman, even when the antique was running with the outboard full out, so Bennett and Scott pushed the throttles flat and bounced ahead to check for traffic downriver as it opened up onto the vast Chesapeake. One of them would always keep the Lyman in sight and periodically check the radar display set at 10 miles range to keep an eye out for the heavies, the tankers and container ships plowing up the channel to Baltimore. They would then pound back to the DCIA, take station astern in a violent turn that sent spray flying in the early sunlight, and throttle back in his wake, smelling the boss's pipe smoke even 200 feet astern. The process of darting ahead then racing back was repeated as required, especially if an unknown boat, runabout, cabin, cruiser, or tacking day sailor, looked as if it would pass close by. There was only one rule. The rib had to keep off at least 100 yards when the DCIA began fishing. The noise of the burbling murk outboards would scare off finicky stripers in the Gulf Stream, for Christ's sake, not to mention around Thomas Point Shoal at the mouth of the river or Bloody Point Bar, 5 miles across the bay, off the tip of Kent Island on the eastern shore. These two spots were Larson's favorites, productive and not too far from home. He tied on a slug-go, a 5-inch bone-white plastic worm with a flattened tail that made the lure undulate irresistibly to predatory stripers. He tried the rock ledge around the historic Thomas Point Lighthouse, the frivolous hexagonal house on stilts with green shutters and 6 gables, with the Fresnel light and a pagoda roof cupola, like a cherry on a Sunday. No one was home around the ledge. Stripers sometimes go deep and suspend. feeding on deep bait fish schools, not unlike some members of Congress, Alex thought, retrieving his lure, setting down his rod on the aft deck and clambering over the front seat stanchion to sit behind the wheel, a little tricky with the lyman's tipsiness. He cranked up the Johnson with the electric starter, eased the throttle ahead, and waved to the guys in the rib, who, bored stiff and soporific from the rocking of the waves, actually didn't see the lyman settle down in the water and swing east to cut across the bay to Kent Island, until the DCIA gave them two shorts and a long on the horn. Embarrassed, they escorted the lyman across the ship channel, watching for traffic. Larson could estimate where Bloody Point Bar was by taking bearings between the breakwater of the Kent Island Marina and the collapsed seawall off Bloody Point Beach. Alex kept his eye on his bearings, and about a mile offshore killed the outboard, stood in the aft deck balancing easily against the roll, and tried a few casts with a silver spoon. Bennett and Scott in the rib took station 150 yards upwind of the little lyman so they'd be drifting down to it instead of away from it. A typical grimy oyster boat, a Chesapeake dead rise, describing the hard sheen or angle of the bottom built for stability, with a plumb bow, forward doghouse, and long open stern, was working closer to the beach, dragging for oysters. The single oysterman was reeling in the sharp-toothed dredge that dislodged the oysters from their beds and scooped them into a steel mesh basket by the bushelfuls. Bennett and Scott didn't know enough to notice that the oysterman was not emptying his dredge, but rather was just casting up and down the beach without result, about half a mile from the lyman. Alex Larson didn't notice either, because he had already hooked a 30-inch striper that probably went 15 pounds, and was intent on bringing in another one. Something else. None of them noticed what an instinctive sailor would have marked in the sky by late morning. The weather. Heated by the sun, moisture from the Gulf of Mexico was rising over the bay into the atmosphere, where it collided with a stream of cold air, eventually spreading out to create the anvil top of a storm cell. As water built up in the thunderhead, it began to rain, and the temperature variance created wind shears of 60 knots, accompanied by thunder and lightning. Neither Alex Larson nor the agents in the rib recognized that the thunderhead was building to a classic squall. The rest of the sky was blue, and the surface of the bay was riffled by a mild chop. The oyster boat incongruously kept up its non-dredging, marginally closer to the lyman. Then it happened. From the surface of the bay, the black lowering clouds with slanting rain bands were preceded by a sick gust of hot air, followed by the white froth of torrential rain moving across the water like a visible shockwave. The first sheet of horizontal rain and gale force wind heeled the lyman over as a tremendous clap of thunder tore the sky apart and a bolt of lightning lanced into the water beside the boat, the shaft surrounded by green plasma. Larson balanced precariously on the runabout, which was rolling from gunwale to gunwale, as he threw on a rain slicker from the locker. The rain stung his face like needles, and the insane wind got up inside the jacket until he could zip it. He dropped his rod on the deck and he held on to the side rail, deafened by thunder, wondering if the lyman would roll all the way over to turn turtle. The wind dropped for a beat, then came roaring back stronger than before, shifting 90 degrees, making the lyman roll so far over that she shipped a bathtub's worth of slate-gray water. Two more of those and his precious antique would sink from under him. He tried inching toward the forward stanchion to get to the wheel, to start the outboard and get her bow into the wind where she'd settle down and where her nose-up attitude would let the self-bailing bilges get the seawater out of her. But he couldn't let go. The damn hull was still rolling, and Larson's face was slapped by sea spray at each downward roll. He looked with amazement as a rubber glove rose out of the foaming water, then another, to grasp the side rail and pull violently down with the next roll. Larson was tilted so far forward that the gunwale banged his knees and he catapulted into the water. The salt stung his eyes, his glasses had flown off, and he felt his clothes and boots filling with water, and he knew he had to shuck off his boots, get out of his slicker, and kick to the surface. Bennett and Scott would be alongside to haul him into the rib, bail out the lyman, and tow her home. Instead, he felt the rubber glove grasp him by the collar of his rain gear, turn him upside down, and begin pulling him deeper, where the water was colder, and where the stripers eyed the fluorescent lures dangled by men in cockle-shell boats up there in the sunlight. Alex Larson did not think of Vladimir Putin as his breath gave out and he swallowed seawater.